Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Ben Hunter. I'm joined by the ever well-read Sarah McDewling. And today we have with us Maurice Gleitzman. Welcome.
It's so nice to meet you.
Well, it's very nice to be here.
Now, you are here today to talk about your new book, amongst other things. I think there's plenty we want to talk to you about. But just for the podcast listeners, would you mind just telling them a little bit about Help Around the House?
Well, Help Around the House is a new story for me, new characters, new situation, not linked to any of my other series. And it comes out of my long fascination with how young people see the world. When we reach about 9, 10, 11 years of age, we're starting to look at the world through our own eyes, and we're starting also to think about what our place might be in the world of our future. And, well, the world changes all the time, so different generations of kids have different prospects ahead of them. And I think it's fair to say that there probably hasn't been a generation of young people faced with a more challenging set of problems, as well as some very exciting opportunities in their future over the next 10 or 20 years as they move into adulthood. And I listen a lot to young people when I visit schools, and I'm aware that there are some challenges, but also some, as I said, some great opportunities. And I thought that it would be interesting to write a story about a young person who's just at that stage where they're starting to see the world through their own eyes, getting their first personal sense of what seems fair, unfair. And most kids do a lot of work in their imaginations in this area. And if I was, you know, if I was the Prime Minister, or if I was in charge of everything, I'd be, you know, changing this and doing that and making that fairer and making that easier for people, etc. And I thought it could be fun and interesting to have a young character whose life circumstances takes them much closer to the seat of power. And so I've got Ludo. He's 11 years old, and his dad has just been elected as an independent member of parliament. And Ludo's mum has died a couple of years earlier, so it's just the two of them, and they moved to Canberra together. And Ludo has got a whole list of things that he thinks need improving, and ways in which life in Australia and in the world in general can be made better for many people. And he is a little shocked when he discovers that that a lot of the effort that our elected representatives and the public servants who are meant to help them, a lot of the time and effort that these people produce is and consume is tied up in not actually helping anybody, not actually making the world a better place. It's in having squabbles and forming gangs and calling other people names and being very protective of their own jobs, and all very understandable human pursuits, but to my particular character, a bit of a shock. He thinks there's a better way of doing it, and he sets out to firstly suggest, when he finds that adults often don't take those sort of suggestions from kids seriously, he then sets out to demonstrate to them how things could be done a little better.
Well, I'm utterly charmed. I just sat down with the book today and read the first few chapters, and I have to say, I wish there had been a book like this for me when I was younger, because I would have probably taken more of an interest in politics. I feel like it's, I tend to try and stay away from politics a little bit, but, you know, I just feel like a book like this would have really made me think about it more. Are you hoping that, you know, as well as telling a great story, that you might be as giving some lessons as well?
I would hesitate to use the word lessons, but I hope that it certainly inspires young readers to not only think about the way that we organise our society, in that it probably is quite a good idea that we don't all try and run our society all together, because that would get pretty unwieldy. So the notion of us electing a few people to do it on our behalf is a reasonably good one, but I think both those of us who are a long way from Canberra or any of the areas of power in the world, we tend to forget that the people who are doing those jobs are in fact just people, often like us. And I think perhaps the people forget it themselves, our elected representatives, that it's a culture that's grown up in the parliamentary communities of the world, I think, that they're not really allowed to just be people. They have to pretend to be something else. But they are so obviously people, and so much of the behaviour is the result of all the human insecurities and all of the human foibles and weaknesses and delusions and strengths sometimes that we all have. And that, I think, is one example of how sometimes young people of a certain age can see things with simple clarity, and that's what Ludo does from time to time. He's in the Scouts, and so he's had a bit of experience in how, if you approach it the right way, individuals or small groups can actually make quite a difference. Helping is available, and solutions to at least some problems are not hugely difficult, as long as you're focusing on the people you want to help rather than the people that you think might be trying to take your job or who might want to look more helpful than you. And as soon as you turn around and start squabbling and fighting with them, it's like in the Scouts, I didn't actually put this in the book, but at one point I was thinking it'd be like there's only two Scout troops in the country, and they both want to do really good things to help as many people as possible, but they want to be the best. They want everyone to think. So bit by bit, they lose sight of the people that they're actually meant to be helping and concentrate more and more on how can we make the other Scout group look really bad and how can we look better. And fairly quickly, you've got two Scout troops who are focusing entirely on each other and calling each other names and telling stories to the media about how you wouldn't believe how awful they are and what they really want to do. They don't want to help anybody. They just want to, et cetera, et cetera. And that's kind of what's happened.
I really love that view of things, and I love how strongly it comes through just in the small bit that I've read. You know, and obviously I'm older than the target audience for the book, but I really caught myself double thinking, like second guessing some of my automatic responses to politicians, where everyone's a fat cat, everyone's, you know, but a lot of people go into politics to make a difference and to help people.
I think the experience that Ludo and his dad see could happen to them, and I'm not going to give too much away, but they managed to avoid the worst possibilities. I think I can say that. So the story has quite a positive end. I think it happens to a lot of people, and I actually, this is one of Ludo's perceptions. He catches himself starting to feel very critical about how much time and energy the average MP spends not helping other people, but perhaps it could be said helping themselves insofar as trying to keep themselves in their job and keep their reputations flying high. But when he stops and thinks that people wouldn't go to Canberra as politicians with a view to doing that, this must be something that happens to them once they're there because of the way that parliamentary system works and the parliamentary culture works. And he starts to feel quite sorry for them, and he starts to feel that with a bit of help, maybe they can be rescued from being trapped in this adversarial, you know, focus on the other lot and trying to seem better than them. And that, I think, is a much more interesting and constructive line of thinking for young people as well, rather than, because as soon as we dismiss our democratic system as a broken thing in which turns, you know, which either attracts only monsters or turns ordinary people into monsters in day by day in Parliament House. We've sort of thrown up our hands and said, well, that's not working, and it's beyond the power of most young people to think realistically about a total alternative. Much better to say, well, I think they've taken a wrong turn somewhere, but they can be saved. And that's pretty much what Ludo's setting out to do. By example and with the odd sort of the odd nudge as well.
It must be such an interesting contrast to see the father who's coming to Canberra for the first time as an independent. His first impression of the house with all his preconceptions, and then at the same time, Canberra through the eyes of a child.
Yes, well, it's interesting because we don't see a lot of it through the father's eyes, because he is not physically present through most of the story. He has had to go urgently and unexpectedly away to do some political task, the true nature of which doesn't come apparent until very late in the story.
Oh, I see.
And so it leaves Ludo with his own desire to do the same sort of community help as that he's done in their previous community through the Scouts, but finding that things are quite a bit different in Canberra, that there's just a different set of assumptions. And also, I'm hesitating now because
it's got a tiptoe around spoilers.
How much do I want to give away? Let's say that he discovers some things that are going on in Canberra that horrify him, and he discovers that they're connected to some fears that large numbers of MPs have, that that this could reflect badly on them. So his attempt to help in a situation, he's actually doing the opposite to what he really wants to do. Instead of helping politicians, giving them some support to do their job better, he's actually causing them to duck for cover. And oh, look, this sounds terribly, terribly non-specific, doesn't it? Terribly abstract. It's because I don't want to give away too much of the story.
You're just going to have to read it.
See, and here's the irony. I've been sitting here for the last 10 minutes sounding like a politician. you ask me questions and I'm skirting around. I'm using generalities. I'm refusing to be pinned down.
The difference, now, Maurice, is that I'm hanging on your every word, and I rarely do that with politicians.
You're not falling asleep. Well, speaking of official roles, you have spent probably a better part of a career gallivanting around schools and engaging people with writing for young people and the written word and your own books. But now you've come into this very officious role as a children's laureate.
Yes. If I could do a little bit of editing there, I would. I feel inclined to replace the word officious with prestigious, perhaps. Ooh, is the word you were going for. I don't know. I'm sorry. No, I'm joking. It's actually, look, laureate is a pretty kind of posh sort of word, and I wasn't exactly sure what it meant. And because in other countries like Britain, they have children's laureates, but they also have poet laureates that have been going for much longer. Half the people I meet think that I'm writing poetry for children, which is charming, but actually not the case. And I accepted this very kind and welcome invitation to be the children's laureate this year and next, because I had spoken to a couple of the previous laureates during their time, and I had a sense of what the opportunities might be. And I could see that these opportunities fitted so well with work and ideas that I've been had central to my professional life for quite some time. And what I am keen to do, the job generally is just to be a spokesperson and an ambassador for all of the good things that reading brings us. But for quite a few years now, I've found myself thinking a lot, and this is to do with my earlier comments about how young people see the world today and how they think and feel about their possible place in that world, and just, you know, how is it all going to go, human society and our planet? I mean, there's lots of signals that young people are getting from adults that all is not well, and there's no certainty that how things are going to turn out. These are big things for young people to think about. And what I've been aware of for a long time is that we can't expect young people to feel confident and creative and optimistic about either their personal place in the future world or how human society is going to go in their lifetime and the lifetime of their kids and beyond, unless they are equipped to feel that they've got some tools to work with. Mm. Embedded in every story, every good story, and particularly stories for young people, is a whole collection of tools, a whole collection of experiences we have when we read a typical story. Now, stories vary in every possible way, but the dynamic of them, the way they work, is pretty consistent. You've got a young character, at least one, confronting a huge problem in their life, at least one problem. And it is usually, in, I think, the stories that young people like best, the problems are bigger than anything the young characters faced before. There's no obvious and easy solution. There's nothing going to be comfortable and easy about this. It's going to involve, for the young protagonist, firstly, no choice. There's no running away, putting your head under a pillow with this problem. This is so urgent and threatening. You've simply got to try and deal with it. Survive it if you can't solve it, but hopefully solve it. It requires the young character to think bravely and honestly about their place in relation to the problem. Am I causing this problem? Am I responsible for it? And to be absolutely realistic about how big and urgent threatening the problem is. Then they have to make another very honest judgment. Am I capable of even surviving this on my own? Do I need help? Often help is required, and that can involve forming new friendships and alliances, lots of interpersonal experience and skill coming to the fore. Sometimes they discover that there's another individual, group of individuals who are responsible for the problem, and tough and unpleasant though it is, putting yourself mentally and emotionally in your enemy's shoes can be a really useful thing. Of all the types of empathy that stories help us, that stories require young main characters to develop, and therefore as readers help us come to understand and develop, I think empathizing with an enemy is the toughest, but often the most useful. Once you've got all your sort of understanding of the problem and you've got your help and new friendships and you're ready to actually start forming some problem-solving strategies, you're going to use all of your imaginative, creative thinking powers. You're going to stretch the possibilities beyond all the limits that you've lived within up till now, and you're going to come up with a problem-solving strategy that you will then put into practice with the hope that it will defeat the problem. And it's a forlorn hope if you're a character in a piece of longer fiction, even a 30,000, 40,000 word novel for young people, because we're only up to page 30, and there's no way that author is contractually able to allow you to solve your problem on page 30. Not when the author is contracted to write, you know, at least 250 pages. So not only are you going to fail the first time you apply that problem-solving strategy, you're going to need, and the author will assist you here, to pick yourself up, not feel crushed by shame and self-doubt, but to look at what happened and to learn in every way you can from the circumstances of the details of the mistake, so that you can formulate another problem-solving strategy. Always bearing in mind that problems never sit still, never wait patiently to be solved. They are always alive, they are growing, they are morphing, they are reacting themselves to the nature of your first problem-solving strategy. So they're always trying to keep one step ahead, and you have to come back with your second problem-solving strategy, still only page 60. Sorry, it's not going to work, but you are going to learn from it. And as you go through this series of failures or half failures, you are developing a resilience, you're developing an understanding that failure does not automatically equal shame and worthlessness. It actually can equal growth and a better chance of solving it next time. Now, all these things are happening on the page and in the imagination of readers. The readers aren't themselves actually physically going through this process, except they almost are. And in ways that is still only half understood, when a young person reads hundreds of stories like this, or even thousands, that process of developing faculties and abilities and potentials, that all those stages of growth that happens for a typical young main character grappling with these huge problems also happens for readers. And so, to put it really simply, if you read 1,000 good stories between the age of 7 and 17, you are going to step into your adulthood and you're going to be capable of facing up to the quite staggering array of challenges as well as opportunities that lie ahead of you much better equipped than if you didn't read those stories. And that is something that I think all of us who work with young people and their books, we know this. Young people who are engaged with the stories, they know it too. It might not be expressed in quite that way, but they know it. The people who don't know it or who have forgotten it are often adults who've spent a decade or two or three in an adult culture that often gets distracted from the sheer practical value of stories. A lot of adults use stories as pure kind of escapism, and they have, whatever these stories are actually doing for them, they think these stories are something other than their daily lives and the problems of their lives and our communities and the world. And some of these adults, obviously, teachers still get it, librarians still get it, but some of these adults at a policy, at a purse strings level, are actually making decisions on behalf of communities and the nation sometimes that really affect the opportunities that kids have to read stories. They're making decisions about the future of school libraries, about the future of school librarians, about curriculums, about methods of assessing schoolwork and what can be easily quantified in a standardized assessment system and what can't. And my perception, as somebody who's been knocking around kids and their books for a few decades, I've been to over 2,000 schools, I've talked to a lot of people at every level, I think there is a danger that, particularly among the people whose decisions, whose policy and financial decisions can make a huge difference, there is a danger that stories are being a little bit, or the value and what stories have to offer is being a little bit forgotten and lost. So I see my central role as Children's Laureate, and I plan to do it using far less words than I have in our discussion this afternoon, is to remind people, maybe by taking them back to their own childhood and talking with them about their reading, or if they were unfortunate enough to have a childhood that didn't have a rich diet of good stories in it, to introduce them to some achievers in their own chosen field, because everyone, it's easy to say, well, he's a children's author. Of course he wants people to read books. but, if I can match sort of politician with politician, bureaucrat with bureaucrat, whatever, then they will maybe listen and be convinced.
That was phenomenal. I feel like standing up and giving you a round of applause. I got chills when you were talking about the importance of storytelling. That was like a blueprint. We've started out as a blueprint for how to tell a good story, and then it just turned into how to live a good life. I loved listening to that. That was amazing.
Well, something that I think every author should probably both be aware of and acknowledge is that, even old, relatively old hands like me who've been doing it for a few decades, I've jumped very late in the piece onto a kind of a cultural stream that's been with us for, you know, millennia. And there are reasons for that. Stories have only stayed at the center of our human discourse because they give us things we need and things we want, but most importantly, things we need. And it is fascinating because our societies have changed so much, the technology through which we share all communications have changed massively, of course, in recent decades, let alone recent centuries and a few millennia. But if you strip away some of the surface characteristics that come from the methods of communication, and if you strip away some of the sort of cultural experimentation that's gone on, say, in the second half of the 20th century, there was lots of playing with, you know, fiction from a philosophical or a cultural analysis sort of point of view, but cultural theory point of view. But these were very sort of temporary sort of little intellectual games, really. If you look beneath that at what stories have always been, stories haven't changed much. And stories for young people are a very useful reference point because they have stayed largely free from the sort of surface playing with, you know, the nature of fiction and all of that. That kids have too great a need and a desire for pure story to be distracted for too long by that sort of, you know, playing with the form, or to be wholly satisfied with the sort of merchandise-driven, you know, playing with the form that also happens. I mean, there's a lot of very oversimplified uses by commercial interests of the story form, which is not really about telling stories. It's about leading young people to purchase or request products. And I know that those things can be distracting briefly, but they're not. They never stop young people coming back to real stories.
Mm.
And that sort of potted paradigm that I just outlined has been, you know, it's been the hero's journey, if you like. It's been the human thread that has run through our stories forever. And so, you know, we big-headed and sometimes overly self-regarding authors can, I think, do ourselves a favour by being reminded that we are just retelling the stories that our species and our cultures have always told. And we may not be doing it consciously, but we are, because we're all the product of all the stories that we have been told and we've read. And story is a language. And like all languages, it's constantly sort of, well, it's alive. But actually, that's actually not a good metaphor, because story isn't as changeable. It doesn't want to change in the way that language does.
Mm-hmm.
It actually wants to, there are many changeable bits in stories, but that basic sort of shape, that basic journey, and those components I outlined, I think, are pretty universal and they are pretty timeless.
Yeah.
And actually, see, these conversations are so useful because I've just had a thought in a way that I've not quite had it before, which is that when I'm trying to convince people who either have forgotten or don't know, who never had the chance to experience what stories can give us, I could try logic. I could say, why would they still be at the centre of our human discourse after millennia if they weren't giving us something absolutely irreplaceable and vital and precious?
Well, that's hard to refute.
That's very hard to refute, absolutely. Do you think I can trust logic when I go into the halls of power in Canberra? I don't know. We'll have to see.
What would Ludo do?
Well, yes, exactly.
It has been fantastic listening to you today. I think before we sign off, I really want to take you back to something we were talking about off air, if I will, which was around education and the kind of modes of practice in education today around rigid and standardized testing on children and kind of gradation of reading levels and how these how the more intangible qualities of reading are really hard to find, particularly in really rigid sort of NAPLAN style testing. I'm wondering if you could sort of just give the educators and the librarians and the parents who might be listening just a taste of, you know, what do you think as author and children's laureate that we might do to just help make those really good stories just that little bit more available and less scary?
Well, I think if every school had a real, passionate, qualified, experienced teacher librarian who... These people should be regarded in the way that the very special holders of wisdom and the precious things from the past of ancient communities, these people were held in such high regard because they were vital. And the teacher librarian can play that role because often she, sometimes he, is the absolute conduit to a whole range of reading experiences that can transform, that can support and help young people develop in all sorts of ways that they wouldn't otherwise be developing. What I'd say, and there are lots of other practical things just to do with curriculums that recognise that time spent on things that aren't easily quantifiable with standardised testing. I know it's very tempting for politicians to offer busy and harassed parents just a simple set of figures or, you know, a couple of times a year, whatever, that is going to apparently let them know exactly how the kid's doing at school, exactly how the school's doing compared to other schools. And education isn't a process that benefits from that at all. That desire to make it that simple and that easily digestible is working against everything that I think every parent would want education to give their young people. I would put it like this. Young people are not going to turn into happy and fulfilled adults, members of a human society that will flourish through coming generations or even exist in a few generations, unless young people are coming out of their education with the capacity for empathy, resilience, an understanding that the last couple of generations' opportunities to be very individualistic and to base all of their self-worth and the value of their life and their lifetime on what they have individually achieved, earned, how much money, how big a house, all the rest of it. We're going to have to go back to a notion that the value of our life lies in how successfully we have worked together as groups, because the things that need to be achieved, they are enterprises, they are challenges and problems that are far too big now for individual success to make a difference. So these are very hard to measure. We're talking about the maturation of the human ego, the opening of the human heart, not in a foolish and passive way, but in an active and choice-driven way to be open to putting the love of one's community and one's fellow human being in a place where we're prepared to accept some physical, some personal discomfort sometimes, and even some slightly lessening of individual opportunity for the greater opportunity and survival and flourishing of our communities. And these are complex, sometimes half forgotten priorities that need to be rediscovered. I believe absolutely that young people are capable of taking the human race into the place that all of us would like it to go and to be long term. But we need to reprioritize what's happening in schools. We need to take back from the powerful forces that fill young people's lives with stories, messages, temptations, that is all about selling them products. We need to take back some of that space for working with and for each other. And there are no simple answers, there are no simple recipes, but a really good starting point is to look at the way young characters behave in stories for young people, because a lot of those somewhat daunting sounding things that I've just listed are happening time and again without too much pain, without people turning into some other weird species that are so different it's scary. It's all there, and it can be rehearsed, and it can be given a run to see how it feels like in each individual reader's imagination. Nobody has to commit to anything yet. You can just see how it feels like, and you can work out where your place might be in this process. But NatPlan is not going to save our human community. That's probably the simplest way I can express that.
Wow.
Well, we need to sign off there. That was fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today.
That's my great pleasure. And I would just like to add one more thing to because I think your listeners deserve to hear this. We've just had a wonderful conversation, and my two hosts here are, of course, they excel at this business of sitting an author down in a small, slightly soundproof space and drawing out of him or her things that person may never have said in public before. But I do just want you to know that this is not a pair of effete intellectual sort of culture vultures kind of dilettantes who just sit around all day sort of tossing these ideas around. I want you to know that this is backed up with serious, physical, practical sort of grunt. You know, they've had me at a table signing hundreds of books. I couldn't have come close to signing that many books if they hadn't been standing at my shoulder, just opening books, putting them in front of me, taking them, putting them back in boxes. absolutely superb. I think that it's that combination of, you know, visionary thinking and, you know, roll up the sleeves and actually get some of it done on a practical basis. This is what's going to save our human community, and I'm delighted to see that these two young people at least have got what it takes.
I think I'm blushing
more,
a little
more
bit.
Books out. Morris, thank you for joining us. Morris Glatzman's new book, Help Around the House, is published by Penguin. You can order it now, along with all of his enormous back catalogue of books. I think that's over 40 books now. Order all of them right now on booktopia.com.au. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.